good afternoon. It's Rod McClure here with you with our Monday afternoon book reading. But before we go any further, a word from the people who help make our little station possible.
Braidwood FM sponsor Dojo Bread are an artisan bakery in historic Braidwood, New South Wales, specialising in German-style bread, fresh pies, sausage rolls and cakes. The dream of one, but the creation of many. Now located in 90 Wallace Street, Braidwood, specialising in crusty white Vienna, mixed grain sour, beer bread cob, caraway rye sour, bagels and the brick. There are many types of bread, but this is Dojo Bread. 0407 222 334. Braidwood FM sponsor Braidwood Veterinary Surgery are open Monday to Friday 9am to 5pm and Saturdays 9 till noon. They've been providing high quality veterinary services to Braidwood and the surrounds since 1989, and they also provide dog grooming services on site, including nail clipping, washing and drying, tidy ups, dematting and de-shedding. You can call them on 48 42 2697.
Braidwood's Half-Cut Barber is now open at the Braidwood Hotel, offering traditional grooming services for the men of Braidwood. Walk-ins are welcome. Contact Half-Cut Barber, Braidwood's, through their webpage. Proud sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
Marshall Dunn has been a traditional signwriter since 1976, with a passion for signwriting, with many of his signs adorning businesses in Braidwood. If you need signwriting, lining and scrolling on trucks, cars, horse floats, brick walls or roller doors, glasswork, a routed house name for a property, or even vinyl lettering, then Marshall Dunn Signwriting is the business to call. 0416 232 397, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And thank you to our sponsors. They help us to keep the station running as it does. Well, we've been reading Ivanhoe, and if you'll remember, Rebecca and Wilfred of Ivanhoe himself, along with Cedric and, of course, the beautiful Rowena and Athelstan, have been captured by De Bracy and, of course, the rather wicked De Boeuf. And, well, we know already that Cedric and Athelstan are eating, but what happened to Isaac, the father of Rebecca? Well, he's now confronted in a dungeon by two Saracens and Front de Boeuf himself. The motions of these men were slow and solemn. If there intended over their souls some preconception of horror and of cruelty, Front de Boeuf himself opened the scene by thus addressing his ill-fated captive. "Most accursed dog of an accursed race," he said, awakening with his deep and sullen voice the sullen echoes of his dungeon vault. "See you these scales?" The unhappy Jew returned a feeble affirmative. "In these very scales shall you weigh me out," said the relentless baron, £1,000 after the just measure and weight of the Tower of London." "Holy Abraham," returned the Jew, finding voice through the very extremity of his danger. "Heard man ever such a demand? Who ever heard, even in a minstrel's tale, of such a sum as £1,000 of silver? What human sight was ever blessed with the vision of such a mass of treasure? Not within the walls of York. Ransack my house and all of my tribe. You will find the tithe of that large sum of silver that you speak of." "I am not unreasonable," answered Front de Boeuf, "and if silver be scant, I refuse not gold. At the rate of a mark of gold for each 6 pounds of silver, you shall free thy unbelieving carcass from such punishment as your heart has never even conceived." "Have mercy on me, noble knight," exclaimed Isaac. "I am old and poor, and I am helpless. It were unworthy to triumph over me. It is a poor deed to crush a worm." "Old you may be," replied the knight, "more shame to their folly who have suffered you to grow grey in usury and knavery. Feeble you may be, for when had a Jew either heart or hand? But rich it is well known you are. I swear to you, noble knight, said the Jew, by all which I believe and by all in which we believe in common... Perjure not that yourself, said the Norman, interrupting him, and let not your obstinacy seal your doom until you have seen and considered well the fate that will await you. Think not I speak to you only to excite your terror and practice on the base cowardice you have derived from your tribe. I swear to you, by that which you dost not believe, by the gospel which our church teaches, and by the keys which are given her to bind and loose, that my purpose is deep and peremptory. This dungeon is no place for trifling. Prisoners 10,000 times more distinguished than you died within these walls, and their fate has never been known. But for you is reserved a long and lingering death, to which theirs would be luxury. He again made a signal for the slaves to approach, and spoke to them apart in their own language, for he also had been in Palestine, where perhaps he had learned his lesson of cruelty. The Saracens produced from their baskets a quantity of charcoal, a pair of bellows, and a flask of oil. While one struck a light with a flint and steel, the other disposed the charcoal, and in the large rusty grate, which we have already mentioned, and exercised the bellows until the fuel came to a red glow. "See you, Isaac?" said Frontibouf. "The range of iron bars above that glowing charcoal? On that warm couch you shall lie, stripped of your clothes, as if you were to rest on a bed of down. One of these slaves shall maintain the fire beneath you, while the other shall anoint your wretched limbs with oil, lest the roast should burn. Now choose between such a scorching bed and the payment of 1,000 pounds of silver, for by the head of my father you have no other option." "It is impossible," exclaimed the miserable Jew. "It is..." Page turn. "Impossible that your purpose can be real. The good God of nature never made a heart capable of exercising such cruelty." "Oh, trust not to that, Isaac," said Font de Boeuf. "It would be a fatal error. Do you think that I, who have seen a town sacked in which thousands of my Christian countrymen perished by sword, by flood, by fire, will blanch from my purpose for the outcries or screams of one single wretched Jew? Or think you that these swarthy slaves, who have neither law, country, nor conscience, but their master's will, who use the poison or the stake or the poniard or the cord at his slightest wink, think you that they will have mercy, who do not even understand the language in which it is asked? Be wise, old man. Discharge yourself of a portion of your superfluous wealth. Repay to the hands of a Christian a part of what you have acquired by the usury you have practiced on those of his religion. Oh, your cunning may soon swell out once more your shrivelled purse, but neither leech nor medicine can restore your scorched hide and flesh were you once stretched on these bars. Tell down thy ransom, I say, and rejoice that at such rate you can redeem yourself from a dungeon the secrets of which few have returned to tell. I will waste no more words with you. Choose between your money and your flesh and blood. As you choose, so shall it be." "So may Abraham, Jacob, and all the fathers of our people assist me," said Isaac. "I cannot make the choice because I have not the means of satisfying your exorbitant demand." "Seize him, strip him, slaves," said the knight, "and let the fathers of his race assist him, if they can." The assistants, taking their direction, more from the baron's eye in his hand than his tongue, once more stepped forward, laid hands on the unfortunate Isaac, plucked him up from the ground, and holding him between them, waited the hard-hearted baron's further signal. The unhappy Jew eyed their countenances and that of Front de Boeuf, in hope of discovering some symptoms of relenting, but that of the baron exhibited the same cold, half-sullen, half-sarcastic smile, which had been the prelude to his cruelty. And the savage eyes of the Saracens, rolling gloomily under their dark brows, acquiring a yet more sinister expression by the whiteness of the circle which surrounds the pupil, evinced rather the secret pleasure which they expected from the approaching scene than any reluctance to be its directors or its agents. The Jew then looked at the glowing furnace over which he was presently to be stretched, and seeing no chance of his tormentors relenting, his resolution gave way. "I will pay," he said, "the 1,000 pounds of silver. That is," he added after a moment's pause, "I will pay it with the help of my brethren, for I must beg as a mendicant at the door of our synagogue before I make up so unheard of a sum. When and where is it to be delivered?" "Here," replied Front de Boeuf. "Here it must be delivered. Weighed it must be, weighed and told down on this very dungeon floor. Think you I will part with you until your ransom is secure?" "And what is to be my surety," said the Jew, "that I shall be at liberty after this ransom is paid?" "The word of a Norman noble, you pawn-broking slave," answered Front de Boeuf. "The faith of a Norman nobleman, more pure than the gold and silver of you and all your tribe." "I crave pardon, noble lord," said Isaac timidly, "but wherefore should I rely wholly on the word of one who will trust nothing to me?" "Because you cannot help it, Jew," said the knight sternly. "Were you now in your treasure chamber at York, and were I craving a loan of your shekels, it would be you to dictate the time of payment and the pledge of security. This is my treasure chamber. Here I have you at advantage, nor will I again deign to repeat the terms on which I grant you liberty." The Jew groaned deeply. "Grant me," he said, "at least with my own liberty and that of the companions with whom I travel. They scorned me as a Jew, and yet they pitied my desolation, and because they tarried to aid me by way, a share of my evil has come upon them. Moreover, they may contribute in some sort to my ransom." "If you mean yonder Saxon churls," said Front de Boeuf, "their ransom will depend upon other terms than yours. Mind your own concerns, Jew, I warn you, and meddle not with those of others."
"I am then only to be set at liberty together with my wounded friend?"
"Shall I twice recommend it," said Front de Boeuf, "to a son of Israel, to meddle with his own concerns? Leave those of others alone. Since you have made your choice, it remains but that you pay down your ransom, and that at a short day."
"Yet hear me," said the Jew. "For the sake of that very wealth which you would obtain at the expense of—"
Here he stopped short, afraid of irritating the savage Norman. But Front de Boeuf only laughed and filled himself up the blank at which the Jew had hesitated. "At the expense of my conscience, you would say, Isaac? Speak it out. I tell you, I am reasonable. I can bear the reproach of a loser, even when that loser is a Jew. You were not so patient, Isaac, when you did invoke justice against Jacques Fitzdotterall, for calling you a usurious bloodsucker when your exactions had devoured his patrimony."
"I swear by the Talmud," said the Jew, "that your valour has been misled in that matter. Fitzdotterall drew his poniard upon me in mine own chamber because I craved him for my own silver. The term of payment was due at the Passover."
"I care not what he did," said Front de Boeuf. "The question is, when shall I have mine? When shall I have the shekels, Isaac?"
"Let my daughter Rebecca go forth to York," answered Isaac, "with your safe conduct, noble knight, and so soon as man and horse can return the tre—"
Here he groaned deeply, but added after a pause of a few seconds,
"the treasure shall be told down on this very floor."
"Your daughter?" said Front de Boeuf, as if surprised.
"Oh, by heavens, Isaac, I would I had known of this. I deemed that yonder black-browed girl had been your concubine, and I gave her to be a handmaiden to Sir Brian de Bois Guilbert, after the fashion of patriarchs and heroes of the days of old, who set us in these matters a wholesome example. The yell which Isaac raised at this unfeeling communication made the very vault to ring, and astounded the two Saracens so much that they let go their hold of the Jew. He availed himself of his enlargement to throw himself on the pavement and clasp the knees of Font de Boeuf. "Take all that you have asked," said he, "Sir Knight. "Take 10 times more. Reduce me to ruin and beggary if you will. Nay, pierce me with your poniard. Broil me on the furnace. But spare my daughter. Deliver her in safety and honour. As you were born of woman, spare the honour of a helpless maiden. She is the image of my deceased Rachel. She is the last of 6 pledges of her love. Will you deprive a widowed husband of his sole remaining comfort? Will you reduce a father to wish that his only living child were laid beside her dead mother in the tomb of our fathers?"
"I would," said the Norman, somewhat relenting, "that I had known of this before. I thought your race loved nothing save their money bags." "Think not so vilely of us, Jews though we be," said Isaac, eager to improve the moment of apparent sympathy. "The hunted fox, the tortured wildcat, loves its young. The despised and persecuted race of Abraham love their children."
"Be it so," said Font de Boeuf. "I will believe it in future, Isaac, for your very sake. But it aids us not now. I cannot help what has happened, or what is to follow. My word is passed to my comrade in arms, nor would I break it for 10 Jews and Jewesses to boot. Besides, why should you think evil is to come to the girl, even if she became Wast Gilbert's booty?"
"There will, there must," exclaimed Isaac, wringing his hands in agony. "When did Templars breathe aught but cruelty to men and dishonour to women?"
"Dog of an infidel," said Front de Boeuf, with a sparkling eye, and not sorry, perhaps, to seize a pretext for working himself into a passion, "blaspheme not the holy order of the Temple of Zion, but take the thought instead to pay me the ransom you have promised, or woe betide thy Jewish throat."
"Robber, villain," said the Jew,
retorting the insults of his oppressor with a passion which, however impotent, he now found it impossible to bridle.
"I will pay you nothing. Not one silver penny will I pay you, unless my daughter is delivered to me, safety and honour."
Are you in your senses, Israelite?" said the Norman sternly. "Has your flesh and blood a charm against heated iron and scalding oil?"
"I care not,"
said the Jew, rendered desperate by paternal affection. "Do your worst. My daughter is my flesh and blood, dearer to me 1,000 times than those limbs which your cruelty threatens. No silver will I give you unless I were to pour it molten down your avaricious throat. No, not a silver penny will I give you, Nazarene, were it to save you from the deep damnation your whole life has merited. Take my life if you will, and say the Jew amidst his tortures knew how to disappoint the Christian."
"We shall see to that," said Front de Boeuf, "for by the blessed rood, which is the abomination of your accursed tribe, you shall fill the extremities of fire and steel. Strip him down, slaves. Chain him down upon the bars."
In spite of the feeble struggles of the old man, the Saracens had already torn from him his upper garment and were proceeding totally to disrobe him, when the sound of a bugle twice winded without the castle penetrated even to the recesses of the dungeon, and immediately after loud voices were heard calling for Sir Reginald Front de Boeuf. Unwilling to be found engaged in his hellish occupation, the savage baron gave the slaves a signal to restore Isaac's garment, and quitting the dungeon with his attendants, he left the Jew to thank God for his own deliverance, or to lament over his daughter's captivity and probable fate, as his personal or parental feelings might prove the strongest. Chapter 23. The apartment to which the Lady Rowena had been introduced was fitted up with some rude attempts at ornament and magnificence, and her being placed there might be considered as a peculiar mark of respect not offered to the other prisoners. But the wife of Front de Boeuf, for whom it had been originally furnished, was long dead, and decay and neglect had impaired the few ornaments with which her taste had adorned it. The tapestry hung down from the walls in many places, and in others was tarnished and faded under the effects of the sun, or tattered and decayed by age.
Desolate, however, as it was, this was the apartment of the castle, which had been judged most fitting for the accommodation of the Saxon heiress, and here she was left to meditate upon her fate until the actors in this nefarious drama had arranged the several parts which each of them was to perform. This had been settled in a council held by Front de Boeuf, de Bracy, and the Templar, in which, after a long and warm debate concerning the several advantages which each insisted upon deriving from his peculiar share of this audacious enterprise, they had at length determined the fate of their unhappy prisoners. It was about the hour of noon, therefore, when de Bracy, for whose advantage the expedition had been first planned, appeared to prosecute his views upon the hand and possessions of the Lady Rowena. The interval had not entirely been bestowed in holding counsel with his confederates, for de Bracy had found leisure to decorate his person with the foppery of those times. His green cassock and vizard were now flung aside. His long, luxuriant hair was trained to flow in quaint tresses down his richly furred cloak. His beard was closely shaved, his doublet reached to the middle of his leg, and the girdle which secured it, and at the same time supported his ponderous sword, was embroidered and embossed with goldwork. We have already noticed the extravagant fashion of the shoes at this period, and the points of Maurice de Bracy's might have challenged the prize of extravagance with the gayest, being turned up and twisted like the horns of a ram. Such was the dress of a gallant of the period, and in the present instance that effect was aided by the handsome person and good demeanour of the wearer, whose manners partook alike of the grace of a courtier and the frankness of a soldier. He saluted Rowena by doffing his velvet bonnet, garnished with a golden brooch, representing St. Michael trampling down the Prince of Evil. With this he gently motioned the lady to a seat, and, as she still retained her standing posture, the knight ungloved his right hand and motioned to conduct her thither. But Rowena declined by her gesture the proffered compliment, and replied, "If I be in the presence of my jailer, Sir Knight, nor will circumstance allow me to think otherwise, it best becomes his prisoner to remain standing till she learns her doom." "Alas, fair Rowena," returned de Bracy, "you are in the presence of your captive, not your jailer. And it is from your fair eyes that de Bracy must receive that doom which you fondly expect from him." "I know you not, sir," said the lady, drawing herself up with all the pride of offended rank and beauty. "I know you not, and the insolent familiarity with which you apply to me the jargon of a troubadour forms no apology for the violence of a robber." "Oh, to thyself, fair maid," answered de Bracy in his former tone, "to your own charms be ascribed whate'er I have done, which has passed the respect due to her whom I have chosen queen of my heart, the lodestar of my eyes. I repeat to you, Sir Knight, that I know you not, and that no man, wearing chain and spurs, ought thus intrude himself upon the presence of an unprotected lady." "Oh, that I am unknown to you," said de Bracy, "is indeed my misfortune. Yet let me hope that de Bracy's name has not been always unspoken when minstrels or heralds have praised the deeds of chivalry, whether in the lists or on the battlefield." "To heralds and minstrels, then, leave your praise, Sir Knight," replied Rowena, "more suiting for their mouths than for your own. And tell me which of them shall record in song or in book of tourney the memorable conquest of this night, a conquest obtained over an old man, followed by a few timid hinds, and its booty, an unfortunate maiden transported against her will to the castle of a robber." "Oh, you are unjust, Lady Rowena," said the knight, biting his lips in some confusion, and speaking in a tone more natural to him than that of affected gallantry which he had at first adopted. "Yourself free from passion, you can allow no excuse for the frenzy of another, although caused by your own beauty." "I pray you, Sir Knight," said Rowena, "to cease a language so commonly used by strolling minstrels that it becomes not the mouths of knights or nobles. Certainly you constrain me to sit down, since you enter upon such commonplace terms, of which each vile crowder hath a stock that might last from now until Christmas." "Oh, proud damsel," said de Bracy, incensed at finding his gallant style procuring him nothing but contempt. "Proud damsel, you shall be as proudly encountered. Know then that I have supported my pretensions to your hand in the way that best suited your character. It is best for your humour to be wooed with bow and bill, then in set terms and in courtly language. Courtesy of tongue, said Rowena, when it is used to veil churlishness of deed, is but a knight's girdle around the breast of a base clown. I wonder not that the restraint appears to gall you. More it were for your honour to have retained the dress and language of an outlaw than to veil the deeds of one under the affectation of gentle language and demeanour. You counsel well, lady, said the Norman, and in the bold language which justifies bold action, I tell you, you shall never leave this castle, or you shall leave it as Maurice de Bracy's wife. I am not one to be baffled in any enterprise, nor needs a Norman noble scrupulously to vindicate his conduct to the Saxon maiden whom he distinguishes by the offer of his hand. Oh, you are proud, Rowena, and you are fitter to be my wife. But what other means could you be raised to high honour and to princely place, save by an alliance with me? How else would you escape from the mean precincts of a country grange, where Saxons herd with the swine which form their wealth, to take your seat, honoured as you should be and shall be, amid all in England that is distinguished by beauty or dignified by power? Sir Knight, replied Rowena, the grange which you condemn has been my shelter from infancy, and trust me, when I leave it, should that day ever arrive, it shall be with one who has not learnt to despise the dwelling and manners in which I have been brought up. Oh, I guess your meaning, lady, said De Bracy, though you may think it lies too obscure for my apprehension. But dream not that Richard Coeur de Lion will ever resume his throne, far less that Wilfred of Ivanhoe, his minion, will ever lead you to his footstool, to be there welcomed as the bride of a favourite. Another suitor might feel jealousy while he touched this string, but my firm purpose cannot be changed by a passion so childish and so hopeless. Know, lady, that this rival is in my power, and that it rests but with me to betray the secret of his being within the castle to Front de Boeuf, whose jealousy will be much more fatal than mine. Wilfred, here, said Rowena in disdain. That is as true as that Front de Boeuf is his rival. De Bracy looked at her unsteadily for an instant. Were you really ignorant of this? Said he. Did you not know that Wilfred of Ivanhoe travelled in the litter of the Jew? A meet conveyance for a crusader, whose doughty arm was to conquer the sepulchre. He laughed scornfully. And if he is here, said Rowena, compelling herself to a tone of indifference, though trembling with an agony of apprehension which she could not suppress. In what is he the rival of Front de Boeuf? Or what is he to fear beyond a short imprisonment and an honourable ransom according to the use of chivalry? Rowena, said De Bracy, are you too deceived by the common error of your sex, who think there can be no rivalry but that respecting their own charms? Know you not there is a jealousy of ambition and wealth as well as of love, and that this our host, Front de Boeuf, will push from his road him who opposes his claim to the fair barony of Ivanhoe as readily, eagerly, and unscrupulously as if he were preferred to him by some blue-eyed damsel? But smile on my suit, lady, and the wounded champion shall have nothing to fear from Front de Boeuf, whom else you may mourn for as in the hands of one who has never shown compassion. Oh, save him, for the love of heaven, said Rowena, her firmness giving way under the terror for her lover's impending fate. I can. I will. It is my purpose, said De Bracy, for when Rowena consents to be the bride of De Bracy, who is it shall dare put forth a violent hand upon her kinsman, the son of her guardian, the companion of her youth? But it is your love that must buy his protection.
I am not romantic fool enough to further the fortune or avert the fate of one who is likely to be a successful obstacle between me and my wishes. Use your influence with me in his behalf, and he is safe. Refuse to employ it, Wilfred dies, and you yourself are not the nearer to freedom. Your language, answered Rowena, has in its indifferent bluntness something which cannot be reconciled with the horrors it seems to express. I believe not that your purpose is so wicked, or that your power is so great. Flatter yourself, then, with that belief, said De Bracy, until time shall prove it false. Your lover lies wounded in this castle, your preferred lover. He is a bar between Front de Boeuf and that which Front de Boeuf loves better than either ambition or beauty. What will it cost beyond the blow of a poignard, or the thrust of a javelin, to silence his opposition forever? No, were Front de Boeuf afraid to justify a deed so open, let the leech but give his patient a wrong draught. Let the chamberlain or the nurse who tends him but pluck the pillow from his head, and Wilfred, in his present condition, is sped without the effusion of blood. Cedric also? And Cedric also? Said Rowena, repeating his words. My noble, my genuine, my guardian, I deserved the evil I have encountered for forgetting his fate even in that of his son. Oh, Cedric's fate also depends upon your determination, said De Bracy, and I will leave you to form it. Hitherto, Rowena had sustained her part in this trying scene with undismayed courage, but it was because she had not considered the danger as serious and imminent. Her disposition was naturally that which physiognomists consider as proper to fair complexions, mild, timid, gentle, but it had been tempered and, as it were, hardened by the circumstances of her education. Accustomed to see the will of all, even Cedric himself, sufficiently arbitrary with others, give way before her wishes, she had acquired that sort of courage and self-confidence which arises from the habitual and constant deference of the circle in which we move. She could scarce conceive the possibility of her will being opposed, far less of its being treated with total disregard. Her haughtiness and habit of domination was therefore of fictitious character, induced over that which was natural to her, and it deserted her when her eyes were opened to the extent of her own danger, as well as that of her lover and her guardian, and when she found her will, the slightest expression of which was wont to command respect and attention, now placed in opposition to that of a man of a strong, fierce, determined mind, who possessed advantage over her, and was resolved to use it, she quailed before him. After casting her eyes around, as if to look for the aid which was nowhere to be found, and after a few broken interjections, she raised her hands to heaven and burst into a passion of uncontrolled vexation and sorrow. It was impossible to see so beautiful a creature in such extremity without feeling for her, and De Bracy was not unmoved, though he was yet more embarrassed than touched. He had in truth gone too far to recede, and yet in Rowena's present condition she could not be acted on, either by arguments or threats. He paced the apartment to and fro, now vainly extorting the terrified maiden to compose herself, now hesitating concerning his own line of conduct. If, thought he, I should be moved by the tears and sorrow of this disconsolate damsel, what should I reap but the loss of those fair hopes for which I have encountered so much risk, and the ridicule of Prince John and his jovial comrades? And yet, he said to himself, I feel myself ill-framed for the part I am playing. I cannot look on so fair a face while it is disturbed with agony, or on those eyes when they are drowned in tears. I would she had retained her original haughtiness of disposition, or that I had a larger share of Front de Boeuf's thrice-tempered hardness of heart. Agitated by these thoughts, he could only bid the unfortunate Rowena to be comforted and assure her that as yet she had no reason for the excess of despair to which she was now giving way. But in this task of consolation, De Bracy was interrupted by the horn, horse-winded blowing, far and keen, which had at the same time alarmed the other inmates of the castle, and interrupted their several plans of avarice and license. Of them all, perhaps, De Bracy least regretted the interruption, for his conference with the Lady Rowena had arrived at a point where he found it equally difficult to prosecute or to resign his enterprise. And here, we cannot but think it necessary to offer some better proof than the incidents of an idle tale to vindicate the melancholy representation of matters which has been just laid before the reader. It is grievous to think that those valiant barons, to whose stand against the crown the liberties of England were indebted for their existence, should themselves have been such dreadful oppressors, and capable of excesses contrary not only to the laws of England, but to those of nature and humanity. But alas, we have only to extract from the industrious Henry one of those numerous passages which he has collected from contemporary historians to prove that fiction itself can hardly reach the dark reality of the horrors of the period. The description given by the author of the Saxon Chronicle of the cruelties exercised in the reign of King Stephen by the great barons and lords of castles, who were all Normans, affords a strong proof of the excesses of which they were capable when their passions were inflamed. He wrote, "They grievously oppressed the poor people by building castles, and when they were built they filled them with wicked men, or rather devils, who seized both men and women who they imagined had any money, threw them into prison, and put them to more cruel tortures than the martyrs ever endured. They suffocated some in mud, and suspended others by the feet, or the head, or the thumbs, kindling fires below them. They squeezed the heads of some with knotted cords till they pierced their brains, while they threw others into dungeons, swarming with serpents, snakes, and toads." But it would be cruel to put the reader to the pain of perusing the remainder of this description. As another instance of these bitter fruits of conquest, and perhaps the strongest that can be quoted, we may mention that the Princess Matilda, though a daughter of the King of Scotland, afterwards both Queen of England, niece to Edgar Atheling, and mother to the Empress of Germany, the daughter, the wife, and the mother of monarchs, was obliged during her early residence for education in England to assume the veil of a nun, as the only means of escaping the licentious pursuit of the Norman nobles. This excuse she stated before a great council of the clergy of England as the sole reason for her having taken the religious habit. The assembled clergy admitted the validity of the plea and the notoriety of the circumstances upon which it was founded, giving thus an indubitable and most remarkable testimony to the existence of that disgraceful license by which that age was stained. It was a matter of public knowledge, they said, that after the conquest of King William, his Norman followers, elated by so great a victory, acknowledged no law but their own wicked pleasure, and not only despoiled and the conquered Saxons of their land and their goods, but invaded the honour of their wives and of their daughters with the most unbridled license. And hence it was then common for matrons and maidens of noble families to assume the veil and take shelter in convents, not as called thither by the vocation of God, but solely to preserve their honour from the unbridled wickedness of man. Such and so licentious were the times, as announced by the public declaration of the assembled clergy, recorded by Edmar, and we need add nothing more to vindicate the probability of the scenes which we have detailed, and are about to detail, upon the more apocryphal authority of the Water Manuscript. Well, that's our book reading for this week. I apologise, the pages, it's an old edition from 1903, and sometimes they sort of stick together a little bit. I'll try and work out a way to stop that happening. Well, even a little bit of history from Scott. Until next week, keep well, Braidwood, and take good care.
Braidwood FM.
Braidwood FM. Local radio.